note that the cessation of hostilities in Lebanon, called for by the Security Council, which came into effect at 0500 hours GMT today, appears to be generally holding.
A piece of paper outlines the way forward, but a lot of times that still has to be conducted by people on the ground. And we'll have to see how all those things work out in the hours, days, and weeks ahead.
The sounds of Kofi Annan, UN General Secretary, sounds of celebration in the streets of Tyre at the announcement of the ceasefire, and Tony Snow, White House Press Secretary, reacting to the ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hezbollah that, for the time being, continues to hold. We're going to be talking about that agreement with Dr. Serge Trifkovic here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. Greetings, I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to start out this week with that news that's at the top of everyone's minds. And, of course, people wait on pins and needles to see whether or not this delicate ceasefire will remain in place. And if it doesn't, then what's next? We'll try and answer some of those questions here in the first half hour of the program. Coming up in 25 minutes, Dr. Uwe C. Minetto joins us to talk about your calling as a Christian, wherever your calling may be, in a time of war. He's director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation. In the second hour of the program, Bob Lico joins us. He's going to start out the theme for the remainder of the program, telling us about a new book titled 23 Minutes in Hell, written by a Pentecostal charismatic preacher. He says he spent 23 minutes. He's not alone. In fact, he's only the latest in many, many, many preachers saying that they visited the nether regions, and in doing so, they come back with insights, new information about hell. Well, that starts a theme for the remainder of the program. If you were watching Dateline NBC last night, you heard about Carlton Pearson. He's been the news in Christian circles for several years now, because Carlton Pearson, once perhaps one of the rising stars in the megachurch movement in Pentecostalism and evangelicalism, anointed by Oral Roberts himself, big Tulsa church, got a revelation. He didn't visit hell. He heard from God that hell didn't exist. And he started preaching it, and his congregation more or less fell apart. He's back, and Dateline NBC talked about him last night. They also talked with Ted Haggard, who was making the case that hell is a real place, and our good friend Bishop John Shelby Spong, making the case that hell is an outdated view, and it's connected to an outdated view of God and of salvation. We're going to have audio open lines playing the better part of the Dateline NBC pieces last night on Carlton Pearson, Ted Haggard, and Bishop John Shelby Spong, getting your reaction during audio open lines from 4:30 to 6 here on Issues Etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We have an in-studio email address. It works just fine. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Serge Trifkovic joins us here for the first half hour. He's foreign affairs editor for Chronicles, a magazine of American culture, and he's author of the book Defeating Jihad, How the War on Terrorism Can Be Won in Spite of Ourselves. Serge, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be with you again. Thank you.
Who benefits from the ceasefire agreement most? Is there a winner in this agreement?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's hard to escape the conclusion that Hezbollah is the winner. The Hezbollah as the primary winner, and Iran, the sponsor of Hezbollah, as the secondary winner.
And why is this? Why is Hezbollah the greatest beneficiary of the ceasefire agreement that began very, very early this morning?
Well, if we think back of the Israeli reaction to the initial Hezbollah attack on July 12th. The reaction, as we know, was fierce. Some would say disproportionate. And it hit more or less indiscriminately various communities in Lebanon, the Shiites, the Druze, the Sunnis, as well as Christians, Maronite, and Orthodox. But what is also significant is that at that time, Prime Minister Olmert and various spokesmen for the Israeli government were saying two things. One, that they were going to hit Hezbollah hard, that their objective is to more or less destroy Hezbollah, to uproot it completely and to degrade its capabilities to the point where Israel would no longer be threatened, and two, that there would be no ceasefire until this objective has been achieved. In other words, that there would be no ceasefire for as long as the Hezbollah retained its capability to attack communities in northern Israel. As we've seen with the last day prior to the ceasefire agreement, i.e. yesterday, neither of those two objectives have been achieved, because it was the day when Hezbollah launched over 250 Katyusha rockets into northern Israel, which was, to all intents and purposes, a show of very bold defiance. Basically, they were saying, this is what we can do on the eve of ceasefire coming into force. And it was obviously a calculated snub to Prime Minister Olmert, calculated in the sense that it was meant to prove that they were not signing anything under duress. Now, in many respects, the latest Security Council resolution, 1701, is almost a carbon copy of the previous one, the resolution 1559 of 2 years ago. What is replicated this time round is the notion that the Security Council supports Lebanese independence, sovereignty, territorial integrity, and unity. Also, the notion that various militias need to be disarmed and disbanded, and that the government of Lebanon ought to maintain the monopoly of military force, and also the notion that outside parties should stay outside Lebanon. And those outside parties in this case are obviously Syria and Iran, even though neither is named. So what is really different about Resolution 1701 that was not contained in 1559? The insistence on the Lebanese army coming into southern Lebanon is meaningless, because let's face it, the Lebanese army does not really exist. It disintegrated on two occasions, first at the time of the civil war of in the mid-1970s, and then for the second time at the time of the second Israeli incursion in the late 80s, which was ended in 2000. And the commander of the Lebanese army, as well as the nominal commander-in-chief, President Emil Ahud, have both expressed support for Hezbollah and their opposition to the disbandment of Hezbollah, which they regard not as a guerrilla organization or as a militia, but as a legitimate and integral part of Lebanese resistance to Israeli incursions. And if we are looking at the situation on the ground as it is today, Hezbollah has not been degraded. The only other force that is supposedly going to keep Hezbollah out of southern Lebanon is the UN force. And the record of the United Nations peacekeepers confronting Islamic militants anywhere in the world, whether it's in Bosnia-Herzegovina with the misutilization of so-called protected zones in the 90s, or whether it's in the Serbian province of Kosovo after the NATO occupation of 99, or whether it is indeed in Lebanon prior to the current situation, where we also had UNIFIL troops in southern Lebanon, effectively condoning and certainly implicitly allowing Hezbollah to arm itself and to shift its personnel around, it would not have been possible for Hezbollah to amass thousands of Katyusha rockets had it not been for the UN quiet acquiescence. The question then remains, who or what is empowered to enforce the UN resolution if Hezbollah does not want to disarm, as I venture to say it will not do. As Yogi Berra would have said, it's difficult to make predictions, especially about the future, and yet I will make this one without too much hesitation. Hezbollah will not disband. Hezbollah will not disarm. Hezbollah is coming out of this one as the most significant anti-Israeli force in the region, certainly more significant than Hamas, certainly more significant than the PLO, quite possibly more significant than the two put together. Now, the position of Hezbollah vis-a-vis Iran is comparable to that of the Third World Liberation Movements vis-a-vis Cuba in the 1970s, for instance, Frelimo in Mozambique or UNITA in Angola, or indeed the position of Cuba vis-a-vis Moscow at that time. In other words, Hezbollah is autonomous in the sense that it does not have an integrated command and control structure that extends all the way to Ahmadinejad in Tehran. But Hezbollah is not fully independent in that its attack against the Israelis on July 12th would not have happened had it not been for Iran wanting it to happen. And we discussed this a few weeks ago. So Hezbollah, as a semi-autonomous subsidiary of the Iranian government and composed not only primarily but almost exclusively of the Lebanese Shia Muslims, is now the single most influential force in Lebanese politics. It also has representatives in the Lebanese government. It also has contingents in the Lebanese army. And it is perceived in the Arab street, this is very important, as the first Arab institution in many years that was successful in challenging Israel, in defying Israel, and in surviving Israeli retaliation.
Certainly.
Who are the losers?
Well, sir, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And as for the losers, I would say that the biggest loser is undoubtedly Israel, because it wasn't able to carry out a well-targeted retaliatory action that would be a true shock-and-awe operation. The indiscriminate nature of the Israeli response created many enemies on the Arab side, even among those who once upon a time would have been Israel's natural allies, such as the Lebanese Christians. And also, I think that within Israel itself, we are already witnessing some signs of political discontent and disunity. Many people believe that the whole operation was very badly mishandled, and that the acceptance of the resolution in its current shape and form is a big defeat for Israel, because it effectively places Hezbollah on the same level with Israel. The institution that used to be attacked as a terrorist organization, the one that was threatened with utter annihilation, is treated in Article 1 of the latest resolution, UNSC 1701, as one of the parties. We have Hezbollah and we have the State of Israel. Now, that in itself is a big slap in the face for Olmert and, of course, a triumph for the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sheikh Nasrallah.
We're talking with Sergey Trifkovic about the ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hezbollah. He's foreign affairs editor for Chronicles Magazine, a magazine of American culture, and he's author of the book Defeating Jihad, How the War on Terrorism Can Be Won in Spite of Ourselves. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues, Etc. A couple questions with regard to why the agreement was then signed. Certainly, Ehud Olmert is fully aware of what this would mean, a rise of Hezbollah prestige. Why in the world would he agree to a ceasefire? And why was the U.S. initially hesitant and then urged a ceasefire?
Well, as far as the U.S. is concerned, I think that the acceptance of the French deal, and let's face it, even though the resolution is the product of the American-French cooperation, it has all key ingredients of the French position rather than the U.S. position. It is the result of the failure of the Israelis to achieve purely military objectives of the operation. In other words, to annihilate Hezbollah in the 4 weeks since the military response got underway, and to do it in a convincing, in a visible, in an unambivalent way. And as far as the Olmert government is concerned, what was the alternative? Frankly, once they decided to march into southern Lebanon, they should not have stopped at the Litani. They should have gone simply all the way to Beirut and kept the whole of Lebanon under occupation, because if you simply take the border strip or part of the coastal strip, it means that the enemy will withdraw out of your reach. It also means that through the lack of political savvy, you have to regard everybody in the occupied zone as an enemy, or at least a potential enemy, and that you don't have the leeway, the maneuvering space that the Israelis did have a generation ago with Major Haddad and his Christian army of southern Lebanon. With Hamas still active in the Gaza Strip, and by the way, watch out for the new flare-up in Gaza in the weeks and months to come, and the Palestinians feel greatly emboldened by the spectacle of Hezbollah first being threatened with annihilation and then successfully defying Israel and ultimately being accepted in the UN resolution as a partner to the deal on par with the Israeli state. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Palestinians now started escalating violence in the West Bank and to an even greater extent in Gaza. What has come to pass and what transpires right now is that the Olmert government is devoid of a long-term strategic concept for containing the threats to Israel and in the longer term for resolving them. And not for the first time, I'll state that short of coming to some kind of terms with President Bashar Assad of Syria and getting Damascus engaged in a regional security deal that would give Assad a stake in the resulting order, he will have no incentive to do otherwise but to remain in cohorts with Ahmadinejad and Iran. In many ways, it's not a natural alliance because Assad is a secularist. He is a Baathist who does not have much time for the Shiite end times ideology and martyrology. He is an Alawite, after all, and not a 12th Shiite. And he would probably feel more comfortable with a deal that would include the Israelis and the Americans that would simply grant him the legitimacy and a stake in the resulting regional order. And so unless and until both the Israelis and the U.S. government realize that some regional political endgame is required as a follow-up to this resolution, there won't be an improvement. Another possible opening is in the fact that many Sunni Arab regimes feel uncomfortable about the rise of influence of Shiite Iran. The success of Hezbollah, and by implication the success of Iran, will greatly raise the stock of Ahmadinejad and of his Shiite proteges throughout the Arab world. This is already obvious in the way in which the Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki has sharply condemned Israel and supported Hezbollah, much more so than any other Arab leader. And at the same time, Mubarak of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan are very uncomfortable about the situation. Their condemnation of Israel was rather muted, and they ventured to actually condemn Hezbollah for what they called irresponsible and short-sighted attacks on the Israelis, from which it's primarily the civilians that suffer. Even the 22-member Arab League issued a statement similarly in tone.
Sergio, I know you're no friend to the position of the Christian Zionists when it comes to the goings-on in the Middle East. How do you expect Christian Zionists to react to this ceasefire agreement?
Christian Zionists will first check out what Bibi Netanyahu and the right wing of Likud have to say before forming an opinion.
What do you expect Bibi Netanyahu to say?
He will demand Ehud Barak's resignation and the formation of a government of national unity in which people like himself will dominate.
You have written recently in Chronicles magazine with regard to the United States' involvement in the Middle East. You say the first task is to reject any immutable givens and to recall that in a volatile region, America has permanent interests, stability, fighting Islamic terrorism, securing energy supplies, and no permanent attachments. What do you mean?
Quite frankly, that I'm sorry, I'm having a bit of a coughing fit. That we should discard the pernicious notion of an existential link between the American destiny and the Israeli destiny. I am a friend of Israel. I am a supporter of the survival of the Jewish state. I am a frequent visitor to Israel, and I believe that the ability of Israel to withstand threats to its existence and to survive is in the pragmatically defined interest of the United States. But I do not believe either that the Israeli state today, secular and democratic as it is in any way a direct heir to the Old Testament covenant, or that it is more special, more unique, and more precious to the American experience than countries such as Great Britain or Germany or France or Greece or Ireland. Israel is a friendly foreign state with which this country has many ties, some of them sentimental, some of them economic, some of them military, some of them security-based. And there is no need, and there is certainly no urgency and no moral dictum to regard it as what the enemies of this strategy would call a passionate attachment that is not to be subjected to critical scrutiny. So once we accept this, what I would call realist position, it becomes easier, it becomes more normal and more logical to form various shifting alliances with other parties in the Arab and Muslim world, primarily those who are not particularly Muslim-minded. And that's where we come back to Syria, because I believe that it just might prove to be a weak link in Ahmadinejad's forming chain of alliances in the region, and that so far that has not been tried simply because the hardline ideologues from the neoconservative camp were actually urging Israel to go after Assad in the same package with Hezbollah, which would have been suicidal and not only counterproductive, but also dangerous for Israel itself.
Sergei, we only have a few seconds left. With only 10 seconds, do you expect the ceasefire to hold?
The ceasefire will hold for a few weeks, maybe a few months, and then we'll be back to square one. A year from now, no one will remember this resolution.
Dr. Sergei Trifkovic is foreign affairs editor for Chronicles, a magazine of American culture. He's author of the book Defeating Jihad, How the War on Terrorism Can Be Won in Spite of Ourselves. You can read his columns on the web at chroniclesmagazine.org, chroniclesmagazine.org. Sergei, thank you for being our guest.
It was a pleasure to be with you, as always. Take care, Tom.
Thank you. Well, when we come back from this break, we are going to turn from affairs foreign to affairs domestic, and I guess some might even term them personal. Your own vocation, you're a father or a mother or a voter, a citizen, you work in the business world or wherever you make your living. What about attending to your Christian calling in a time of war? Dr. Uwe Simonetto says, now, as never before, it is imperative that Christians attend to their various callings. We'll find out why he says that, especially during a time of war, when we come back from this break. Uwe Simonetto will be our guest for the next half hour. That'll bring us up to the second hour of the program. Bob Liko will join us then to talk about a new book titled 23 Minutes in Hell. And then we've got audio open lines for the remainder of the program. Last night on NBC's Dateline, Carlton Pearson was featured. He denies that hell exists. That's coming up later on Issues, Etc.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Deaconess Pam Nielsen, senior editor at Concordia Publishing House, on the Christ-centered cross focus of Growing in Christ, the new Sunday school curriculum from Concordia Publishing House.
We've been very intentional in one, teaching the scriptures. We are concerned about Bible literacy. Pastors tell us they get kids in confirmation that they don't know any of the Bible stories, they don't know any of the Bible people. So we're trying to teach the Bible stories, the who, what, where, and when. But we're teaching them in the context of Christ. And every story, every week, be it Old or New Testament, connects to Christ as the Savior.
For more information about Growing in Christ, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or find the Growing in Christ logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org. It's a Christ-centered, cross-focused Sunday school curriculum, Growing in Christ.
Values-driven healthcare, Swiss style.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
In Switzerland, a number of health insurance companies are giving discounts to women who refuse to have abortions or choose not to undergo in vitro fertilization treatments. The companies provide the discounts through a partnership with a pro-life organization that boasts 40,000 members. Participants can receive a discount of as much as 40% on their health insurance premiums if they sign a pledge saying they will not have an abortion. Offering Swiss citizens a choice in healthcare is saving both lives and dollars. Now that is values-driven healthcare.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org. That's sba-list.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. 45 years ago yesterday, August 13th, 1961, the Berlin Wall was erected. 2 weeks ago, I saw what little remains of that hated wall, that symbol of division between people. Most of the wall's 96 miles are gone. What's gone, sometimes traced in streets or on sidewalks by a different color brick. It's too bad so much is gone. We too easily forget. Our tour group also saw the old defensive walls of Rothenburg on the Tauba River. Those walls are no longer dividing people. They are luring tourist money into that medieval town. I know that for a fact. And the worst wall we saw was the concrete and barbed wire at Dachau, the Nazi concentration camp outside of Munich. Within those walls, people were stripped of their human dignity, robbed of hope and life, always tempted to turn on each other. History teaches that walls like that don't last. How strange, then, that we erect barriers in families and friendships. When Philippians chapter 2 promises the day is coming when every knee should bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, some people will be shamed because of the divisive walls they have built. Are there walls to tear down in your life? Proverbs 20:12 says, "Ears that hear and eyes that see, the Lord has made them both."
If you had the opportunity to share the love of Jesus with people here and around the world, would you do it? Hi, this is Joni Harwell of AM 850 KFUO, asking you to help support KFUO. Please send your donation today to KFUO AM, 85 Founders Lane, Clayton, Missouri, 63105, or go to KFUO.org, scroll down, and press the Give Now button. Let's tell the people of the world that Jesus is their Savior.
Well, things are a mess. No matter what direction you look, things are definitely a mess. You've got a mess in Africa. You've got, and we're not only talking about political and military messes, but you've got the Middle East. You've got Africa. You still have Eastern Europe. You've got the Pacific Rim. It's either a man-made disaster or it's what we call the natural disasters. LCMS World Relief is trying to keep abreast and in touch, which each and every situation that calls for that touch of mercy. LCMS World Relief underwrites issues, etc. They are Christ-centered, cross-focused. 95 cents of every dollar that you support the victims of these tragedies, 95% of every dollar gets to the victims through LCMS World Relief. You can earmark a donation to any of their efforts around the world by calling them toll-free 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438. Find out what their concerns and their aims are worldwide by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief have a myriad of things that you can attend to right there at our homepage, issuesetc.org. For the second half of this first hour, Dr. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. He's an international journalist and director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation. He joins us live from France, and we're going to talk about your calling, your Christian vocation, in a time of war. Uwe, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Good to be back, Todd.
Why should the average person, you know, the guy who goes and simply puts in his 8 hours a day or punches a clock, why should he be any more attentive to his various vocations in a time of war? Why is it more imperative now than ever before?
Well, precisely because that's when we are most challenged during time, in times of war. And that is why we have to be more attentive, because lives depend on it. It also our fate as a society depends on it. We are very prone to very, very bad misjudgments unless we do our jobs well as people with a calling. And the calling, as we've discussed earlier, is also to inform ourselves properly, to think clearly, and to act clearly.
I think especially lately, when the U.S. becomes embroiled in military conflicts throughout the world, the average person, especially the average Christian, tends to think of themselves as more a victim of circumstance. You know, they're the ones who will pay the higher prices at the pump. They are the ones who will send their boys off to war. They're the ones who will have to make tough decisions politically when it comes time to vote here in the United States.
Right.
And we tend to think of ourselves as victims of circumstance rather than active participants in our individual vocations in this enterprise. Set us straight, if you will.
Todd, I tell you one thing. If we begin thinking of ourselves as victims, we're already on the losing side. Obviously, whatever our circumstances are, we have to heed our callings, even if we feel ourselves victimized. And that includes being at the receiving end, for example, of bombing. I know what I'm talking about because I was under bombing, as was my wife, both in different countries and at each other's powers were bombing each other. In times of war, you are challenged to be responsible and not to consider yourself a victim, because once you consider yourself a victim, you cease thinking. And if you cease thinking, you cease being a human being, really. And then you're just, like a beaten dog.
You mentioned just a moment ago your wife. She's a Brit, is she not?
She's British and I'm German.
And, on her side of the war, I've been reading recently some history of this, Uwe. And one of the things that strikes me is the degree to which Great Britain, when war was inevitable, when France was invaded by Germany, it was considered to be one's national duty to pitch in, not just in an active way, but all of industry was called to put its shoulder to the wheel for the war effort. And it was considered to be one's duty as a citizen, wherever one found oneself, to do this. What's been lost? I'm reading this and I'm thinking to myself, these are not people who considered war something simply to watch on television and to get updates on from the evening news.
Right. Well, Todd, here's the thing. I wonder, I mean, we all did, depending on what side you were on, you considered yourself part of a unit, part of a community. Now, irrespective, of course, of the political circumstances, in Germany, where we had a dictatorship and a tyranny, there were a lot of people who quite rightly opposed the system. Nonetheless, even if you live within a system, you have a calling within that system, and you have a sense of community. We discussed earlier in an earlier program Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who returned from the United States to Germany at the beginning of the war, being totally opposed to the Nazi regime, but he wanted to be with his people because he considered himself part of the community. Now, in Britain, obviously, they didn't think of themselves as members, as subjects to a criminal system, which they weren't. So therefore, they were a community, and within the community, you have a calling. We are not born into a void. We are born into communities normally, and so therefore, you act as part of the community. And therefore, within the Lutheran sense or Christian sense of calling, you're called to serve within the community and not to mope and grind and holler and howl and say, well, how terrible it is that we're being bombed. You do something about it and you live within the community. You serve your community. You serve your neighbor. And your neighbor, of course, is Christ, and which is the best approach you can ever have to an international crisis.
You've written recently about what you call three contemporary wars, the war in Iraq, Afghanistan,
right.
That's still ongoing, of course, and Israel's more recent war of survival against Hezbollah. We're sitting right now in that war under a very tentative ceasefire. Let's start with Iraq. Someone says, look, Uwe, it was a mistake to go in the first place, and we shouldn't have been there in the first place. Where do you go from here? What now?
Here's the interesting point. Now, first of all, we've discussed this earlier. Was it correct that we should that America went into war in Iraq or not? But you know, that's another story. You're in there, and you can't undo. You can't uncook a goose once it's cooked. You can't just say, "Well, oops, sorry, I made a mistake cooking that goose. It should actually be running around the yard." So now you obviously have to deal with it as your sense of responsibility and your common sense, which is a gift of God, sees fit. And if you pull out, you chicken out, then you leave your neighbor at a loss. You abandon your neighbor to disaster. If the United States pulled out right now, regardless of what Americans would do to their own country, which means probably depriving themselves of oil supplies, which is not a commendable deed, they would abandon millions and millions of people to tyranny, to insurrection, to slaughter. They would abandon them to probably another tyranny imposed on them by Iran. This is after the United States abandoned their ally, namely the Shah of Iran, in 1979. To another tyranny, a religious and political tyranny. And now we are all doing this, and you know, and never mind, oops, we made a mistake, we shouldn't be in there, so therefore let everybody else get slaughtered and we sit nicely and have our hamburgers. I think this is an appalling thought, and I think for politicians in the United States or for journalists in the United States to even promote this thought is well-nigh criminal. I'm sorry to say that.
Talk about the dangers of either individuals or investing either individuals or governments with the illusion of infallibility when we undertake our secular endeavors. What's the danger
there? Here's the funny thing. I mean, you know, it's actually bearded intellectuals who think that that politicians and others should be infallible, and they themselves are, of course, the most infallible. We all goof. We all make mistakes. We are all placed into situations where we make mistakes. That's the point. We then, therefore, not just say that since we are infallible because we don't make mistakes, even though we make mistakes, we should now become infallible by pulling out of our mistakes, which we didn't make. I mean, this is a most ironic situation that anybody can consider. It's ludicrous. Nobody is infallible, once in your fallible state, you make a mistake, you then have to use your brains to get yourself, and of course, your faith as well. But as citizens of the left-hand kingdom, we have to use our brains to extricate ourselves from a situation, not by abandoning our fellow man, but by considering our fellow man as our neighbor, as members of the body of Christ, as fellow human beings created in the image of God. And so therefore, you are compelled, certainly as a Christian, to ponder the consequences of your fallible acts, and then not compound your fallibility by more fallibility. And that is, I believe, where we are now. We experienced this in Vietnam. You know that I have been a correspondent in Vietnam for 5 years, on and off, and we have seen the consequences when suddenly the sovereign of the United States. And the sovereign of the United States is the people, it's the voter. Nobody, this is not Nazi Germany. It is the United States, where the sovereign of a republic is the people. When they decided to extricate themselves or vote in politicians who would extricate themselves from a screwed-up situation and say, well, we've got to get out, we've got to clean our hands, and then hundreds of thousands died, boat people died in the South China Sea, 3 million people were slaughtered in Cambodia, hundreds of thousands of people wound up in concentration camps called re-education camps, were tortured to death, and the economy grew. This is not responsible Christian behavior. It's not responsible any behavior. It is simply self-righteousness, and which, of course, is the exact opposite of anything that we as Christians or Jews, for that matter, would consider right.
We're talking with Dr. Uwe Simonetto, an international journalist and director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation, about vocation in a time of war. He joins us live from France. You can join us as well. Our call-in numbers, we are coming to you live this, the 14th of August. It's Monday, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. One of the things that concerns me, turning to the issue of Israel's attempt to defend itself from Hezbollah, a valiant attempt to defend itself, but what concerns me is, and this is especially on the part of Christians here in the West, Uwe, the moral compromise that they're willing, that they're apparently blind to, saying, look, Israel can't do any wrong here. They're defending themselves against bad men up to no good. Therefore, whatever they do to defend themselves, even indiscriminate bombing, is justifiable. I find that concerning.
That, of course, it would be as wrong as saying that for Israel not to defend itself would be justifiable. I mean, both sides are wrong. I mean, Israel is not Israel doesn't wear a halo around itself. Israel is subject to fallibility like the rest of us, and therefore we cannot say that anything Israel does is right. The only thing we have to say is that Israel does have the right to defend itself, and that, yes, I do believe that international pressure from Christian countries, from friends of Israel, to insist on Israel's human or humane behavior is correct. I mean, we did do that, but of course the consequences we've seen right now. There is a ceasefire at the moment in place, and people are not getting killed. It is. You see, this is the funny thing. I've lived through so many wars myself, and covered so many wars, and one is always tempted to take one side. And in most cases, there is one preferred side. And in my particular case, I would not even deny that. I would prefer the side of Israel simply because Israel is the last bastion of freedom that separates us in the West from Islamism. But it doesn't mean that Israel's behavior is perfect and infallible. And you see the funny what. We live in this. I think we live in a sort of international Switzerland. You see, you in the United States, we here in Europe. We live in a sort of Switzerland where we eat cheese with holes in it and find everything wonderful. And then and I about the horrible things that are happening beyond our borders. And then, of course, it is very, very easy and very comfortable to take sides, and of course, right now it is fashionable to say how horrible Israel is simply because Israel happens to be pretty much like us and we are horrible people while we're eating our cheese with holes in it. That is as wrong as to say, as to close your eyes to the very fact that Hezbollah, which was a terrorist movement, rained 3,000 rockets on Israel, on civilians, indiscriminately. So where did the stuff come from? and not to consider the very fact that the war in between Hezbollah and Israel is a war in reality between Iran and Israel. And now we're dealing with a totally different set of circumstances, which people do not consider. They just see these images on television and do not consider the backgrounds of this. And this is where I believe my colleagues, your colleagues in journalism, have a very, very important role to play.
You also, from the consumer, we would say consumers of news right. side, you also put a very strong point in a recent column on the subject on the duty of a citizen to inform himself and to remain informed about these things, as difficult as that case may be. Talk about that.
Well, unless you inform yourself properly, you have no right to opine. Or you have a right to opine, but then don't claim the right to also act upon your opinion. In other words, if you are the sovereign, as I said earlier in this program, of your nation, a sovereign of the free of a democratic nation is the voting public. If you are that sovereign, you are duty bound to inform yourself as much as a sovereign and previous nations, the king, would inform himself about the circumstances that might lead him to go to war or to opt for peace. What my main fear is right now, having covered now over a period of 50 years world affairs, is that the sovereign in the republic, or our assorted republics, is no longer willing to inform himself or herself properly, even though the information is available. I mean, if you take, for example, this current case, Israel versus Hezbollah, information is plenty available because you have newspapers to read. You don't have to rely on television alone, and there are good newspapers to read, and there are good magazines to read. You can make up your opinion, your mind, and then decide upon it. You have elections coming up in the United States this fall. The sovereign will make his choice. And if the sovereign makes his choice simply based on images on television without considering the surrounding circumstances, even though the information is available in print, then that sovereign is failing in his duty. And then that sovereign is also failing in his or her calling, which is a divine calling to serve your neighbor in this world, and therefore a divine calling to serve Christ, who is being represented by your neighbor.
Uwe, I'd like your reaction to something the president had to say last week regarding the terrorists that attempted to, or at least had planned to, blow up transatlantic flights headed right. for the U.S. Here's President Bush.
This nation is at war with Islamic fascists who will use any means to destroy those of us who love freedom, to hurt our nation.
Uwe, is Islamic fascists, is that a fair term for the president to use here?
Well, I would call it Islamist fascist, and I don't even know whether fascism is the right word for it. It is evil, period. And why don't we just call it what it is? It's evil. And but apart from that, I thoroughly affirm the president, and I think much as he's being criticized in your country and the rest of the world, at least we should be glad that somebody recognizes that this evil has to be fought and that he is willing to do so. And I think he should be commended for that.
And I asked a previous guest about their optimism or lack of optimism regarding the ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hezbollah. And I don't want to let you go without giving you a chance to make, if you're willing to, make a bit of a prediction. Do you expect the ceasefire to hold?
A ceasefire is always a ceasefire, not a peace. And a ceasefire will never hold forever. This is a ceasefire. You can sort things out. Will it hold? No, because not for a long, long time. Simply because behind the behind Hezbollah is a power as determined to accomplish its purposes or its goals as was Hitler in the 1930s. In that sense, I do understand. I do see what the President Bush meant. I think he used the wrong terminology here, but that's neither here nor there. No, I don't think the ceasefire is going to hold, but we should be grateful nonetheless that as we speak, people aren't getting killed.
And then finally, with less than a minute before we go, you've talked about the need, especially, and you've referred again and again to, in our republic, the sovereign, that is the voter, to be informed, to avail himself of the information that's out there in a time of war. Someone right. who says, look, it's all too complicated, and every day it gets more complicated. The names and the places are changing and shifting constantly. I can't keep up. I'm going to leave that to my elected officials and representatives. How would you respond?
Yeah, well, that's a cowardly behavior. I'm sorry. Yes, you should leave it to your elected officials and what have you. But first of all, you have to elect the elected official. And so it's your responsibility as a citizen of a nation to elect the right people. And even then you should keep informed. I mean, it's sort of like saying, well, I leave it to my car mechanics whether my car is going to run well or not run well. After all, they've checked it out. And then you forget to put the oil into your engine and suddenly it blows in your face. I mean, this is ludicrous. No, you are in. If you want to maintain a democracy, and I sometimes have serious doubts that a democracy is going to survive with this sort of attitude, that people say, well, I leave it to them, and you know, and they don't actually make any major effort to inform themselves. If you want to maintain a republic, if you want to maintain a democratic system, then you can never cease to inform yourself. And it is, you cannot, especially not now in the days of the internet, you can never claim that you do not have the means to inform yourself. It's available to you 24 hours a day.
Uwe Simonetto is an international journalist. He's director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation. You can read Uwe's recent column titled, In Times of War, You Need to Heed the Calling, on the web. Just go first to our website, issuesetc.org. Go on the left side of the homepage, click links, and scroll down to Uwe Simonetto and the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation. Uwe, thanks for being our guest again.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about Mary, the Mother of Jesus, with Dr. Peter Scare of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. And just coming up in a few minutes, we're going to be turning our subject to one that's going to occupy pretty much the rest of today's program. First, a very recent book by Bill Weiss. You might have heard about him. He claims to have spent 23 minutes in hell. He says he was there bodily in one of the many cells in hell and was not tormented, but pretty much had the wits scared out of him by demonic creatures. He got a tour of hell, he says, in those 23 minutes. And he's written a book called 23 Minutes in Hell. And Bob Leko will give us a bit of a review when we come back.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.